Welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I got so many questions, and I'm just trying to figure out where to place them all. But I was just watching Mario Batali and Michael Stipe on a recorded thing of Iconoclast. And I was just wondering, if you were going to be on that show, who would you want to be your co on that? I mean, who's your rock star that you would want on there?
Wow. I don't know, man. You know, Iggy Pop?
Oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Iggy Pop. I've been listening to him since I was in, I guess, junior high school, and some guy kind of turned me on to him, and I was like, oh, cool.
Yeah, I was a Stooges fan from, like, you know, their first album, so,
Yeah.
you know, he's a hero to me. And, you know, apparently a bright, literate guy. You know, actually, I met him years ago, but, you know, when he was still sort of out of control.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would I'd be gushing and you know, near fainting like a, you know, like a Bobby Soxer.
Yeah, I saw him in concert in New York State one time, and I was like in my, I guess I was pre-grunge looking. I had like a strange grunge outfit on, and everybody else was like into the sort of out of the post new wave thing.
Right.
And he came out and was like watching the other show, and I guess he kind of looked over and said, "Who's this weird kid with this outfit on?" You know?
Yeah.
So.
We just did a show in Cleveland with Marky Ramone, so that was sort of you know, a realization of a life's dream as well.
Yeah, I saw them in Staten Island years ago when I was in high school, and I actually wrote a report about them. It was kind of funny for my English class, and that was like truly a historical moment for me.
Oh yeah, and of course
Yeah.
I always wanted to do something with Christopher Walken because he's a passionate cook and has always wanted to do a stand and stir cooking show.
Yeah, I didn't know that about him because he actually came to our club. He comes every year actually for a lunch with one of our members. And he came in once, and I think he had a couple of drinks in him already. And the doorman goes up to him and says, "Oh, hi, Mr. Walken." And he goes, and he kind of said, "Well, what is this, like a cocktail party?" He goes, "No, it's a sit-down lunch." He goes, "Oh, shit."
Well, apparently he loves to cook. He's been pitching the Food Network for some time, and I think scaring them.
Oh, that's interesting, because I know that his family were bakers here in New York City, so that's
Oh,
pretty
yeah.
cool. Speaking of heroes, which hero do you think you would want to be in the food world if you were able to do that kind of transition, magical thing, Carême or Escoffier or who?
Oh man, none of them. I mean, I just don't really feel any kinship with any of those guys cooking at that level, you know. You know, I never really had that kind of dedication to excellence or innovation, or I was never, you know, I was disabused of any notion that I was going to be the next Bocuse, you know, very early. And, you know, I kind of looked in the mirror and looked at my heart and realized that, you know, that just wasn't a priority. I was having too much fun in the restaurant business. And so I don't know. I mean, you know, if I'm looking at people who I really idolize and really look up to in the business, you know, I feel a lot more kinship with, like, but, you know, I guess I look up to Fergus Henderson, Martin Picard in Montreal. You know, those guys, I understand why they do the things they do, you know, and I see what they've done with their careers, and I definitely feel, you know, I wish that, you know, I wish that had been me, kind of a thing, I guess. If, you know, if there's any major figure in cuisine who I just, you know, really admire and look up to and respect and you know, wish I could have done something that important and influential, I you know, would have to be Fergus Henderson.
It was interesting. I had read that he had had a surgery on his brain because he had Parkinson's disease, and then that was something that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, he had very advanced, very you know, I think even experimental surgery. They put copper wires into various centers of his brain and connected it to a computer, connected them to a computer in his chest. And the wires are it's supposed to detect tremors coming, symptoms coming, and then make corrections, stimulate the brain in a way that would mitigate the effects. And I know that for a while, you know, I saw him after the surgery, and he was doing very, very well. I hope it's still working.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like admired his menu just looking at it from the internet and seeing how simple and really.
It's the restaurant that every chef I know who's been there wish they could own. and wish they could get away with running a place like that. I mean, it's absolutely heroic. I mean, he opened it, I think, in like 92. He opened it at a time when that was just about the, you know, the complete antithesis to what everybody else was doing. And, you know, it's a plain white room, just no bullshit, no nonsense, serving English, traditional British country food and a lot of hooves and snouts and guts. And it's just so great, and it's such a wonderful feeling there. It's so free of all the pretense and pomposity and nonsense. And the way that cooks around the world, and chefs for that matter, have responded to what this very unassuming, unpretentious, gentle man has done is really, it's almost a religious experience watching Fergus speak in his halting, rather upper-class British manner of speaking. Watching him address culinary students or cooks at various symposiums has been one of the great joys of my life.
Right. Well, it's funny. A guy that I used to work with gave me a look at your book, and I'd already read your Bone in the Throat, and I loved it because later on my brother happened to work for those types of people in a restaurant, and he had a situation with cutting his hand on a slicer, and it kind of reminded me of your book. And I just started reading Kitchen Confidential, and I was embarrassed because I said, "Gosh, you know, this is really a good book." And it's more like the similarities I found in parallel with your life and my life, in some weird context. Do you think a lot of cooks can relate to that?
When I wrote the book, I really kind of had no clue that anyone other than a few restaurant people in New York were going to read it, you know, for laughs. And I guess one of the more gratifying aspects that it's, I mean, it's published all over the world, and everywhere I've gone in the world, cooks have pretty much said to me, you know, "You wrote my life, man." So that, you know, that feels good, you know, to realize you're part of something, and that you know, even some of the old guard French chefs who, you know, run perfectly impeccable kitchens beyond reproach, you know, they've worked in kitchens like that at some point or other in their life. So, you know, the aspects of the book that apparently highlight what our similarities or our shared experiences, you know, it's great to hear that from cooks in, you know, Barcelona or Sao Paulo or you know, Sydney or Hong Kong. You know, that feels good.
And what is it about the peculiar cooking lifestyle that people want to become cooks today?
I think it's a very welcoming environment for misfits. It always has. You know, the business has always attracted, since very early days, even if you go back to Orwell, it's been a magnet for refugees, for emigres, for, you know, people who've changed their names, who are avoiding something, people who are uncomfortable with the straight real world out there, who have bad communication skills. An extraordinarily high number of dyslexics are attracted to the business. You know, there are a fair number of idiot savants. I would not be shocked if some of the great chefs are like bordering on Asperger's syndrome. You know, it's a welcoming environment for people who are uncomfortable with the ordinary workplace, and find a place that they can excel and be respected and do good work, as well as satisfy them. I mean, there's enormous immediate gratification as well. You know, when you do well in a restaurant, you know, there's no gray areas. You're either good or you're not good. You're either great or you aren't. You need only look to side to side at the other cooks to know if you're doing a good job. And the immediate gratifications of using your sense of smell and taste and a strong back and a good sense of good ability to multitask, all that pressure, it feels good. People, you know, it's very gratifying to people who are struggling to find their way in other professions or felt they never could find their way in other professions, who sense that from the beginning. I think it's useful to read Gordon Ramsay's recent autobiography, and then immediately read DeMarco Pierre White's autobiography, because the two stories overlapped. The similarities between their childhoods and their personalities and really interesting, and kind of touches on a lot of something very universal about what drives people to be great chefs.
And they're sort of, I don't know, I mean, they're really... they're like sort of the perfect chef, but they're really imperfect. So they fit the bad boy image that you've kind of attained. Why do you think people are so gratified or really into that image?
Wow, that I don't. I think a lot of chefs are I think a lot of us have just given up trying to figure that out. You know, most of us remember when we were considered to be, you know, losers and marginal characters in a dead end business. So to find ourselves, you know, in suddenly in a glamour profession, you know, I think we're just grateful for it. I think it's nice to be appreciated, to make some money, and to enjoy some prestige. I think a lot of chefs are first of all, a lot of chefs, and I would include, you know, real type A personalities like Ramsay, like Marco Pierre White, Todd English. You know, these are guys with big personalities, but they're in fact very shy, and I think very, you know, at least until they got used to the media, I think very uncomfortable in social circumstances. You know, they can yell and scream in the kitchen, but you know, the kitchen is an area where that you can control your environment. Outside of the kitchen, I think a lot of chefs feel lost. I don't know. I think chefs are just doing what they're able to do. And, you know, this whole advent of the celebrity chef, you know, is something we've had to learn to adapt to. And some are able to do it, and some obviously, you know, can't. It's, you know, I guess it's like playing, you know, like playing guitar in that sense, in that you know, who is less suited to be a public figure than some kid who spent most of his life in his mom's cellar learning to play guitar, you know? So it's often a bad fit. You know, there are, of course, always a few who rise to the top and, you know, who you know, being a celebrity is kind of easy. You know, it's like putting on chef's whites and going out in the dining room. It's not that big a transition. We always had, like, you know, the person we were in the kitchen and then the person we were in the dining room. So in that sense, we're kind of, you know, ready for television. But a lot of really great chefs just aren't ready for television. And, you know, I admire them at least as much as those who are.
And what do you think television or food television has done? Is it damaging the food industry? Is it playing fun at us? Or are we just falling into it as well? Are we just...
But I think on balance, it's been a good thing for the profession. Anything that raises the prestige of people who cook in general, and more importantly, raises the expectations and degree of knowledge, you know, consciousness about what it is we put in our mouths, that's got to be a positive thing. No matter how annoying or insipid food television can be, and it can be both, you know, to a painful degree, on balance, you know, I may not be, while I admire, I have enormous admiration for Emeril Lagasse as a restaurateur and as a human. I, you know, as I've told him, I hate his show, but I'm, you know, I should probably wake up every day getting out on my knees and thank him for the show, because it's been good for business for all of us.
Sure. So everybody's able to share from that, that good goal that you guys have been giving us.
Some guys get screwed. So there are a lot of chefs who deserve to be doing a lot better than they are, because, you know, it's become more competitive. There are certain chefs who should be doing a lot better than they are, because they're just not good on television or don't want to play the game. So there is definitely a downside to it. But in general, I think food TV has probably, I hate saying this, but it's been good for the world.
So you were, I guess, a rebel sort of chef, and you've become part of the mainstream. Does that kind of hurt you a little
bit? I'm happy to be called a bad boy and a rebel and all the rest of that. That's all fine in itself, yeah. Books. But, you know, I was really never rebelling against anything. I mean, I became, you know, known very late in my career. I mean, I was already in my 40s.
Yeah.
I was set in my ways. I was just too old and too mean and didn't really give a shit. So, you know, to change, you know, geez, I would have, it's nothing to do with integrity or any pose or posture or attitude. It just, you know, this is who I am. I made it big with a nice obnoxious book that was, you know, honest and undiplomatic. I saw no reason, you know, why should I have to suddenly start kissing ass, sucking up, or becoming lovable or TV friendly? You know, I got on TV because of this obnoxious book. I figured, hey, you know, nobody's telling me, you know, I apparently, why should I change? I don't have to, and I don't really want to be on TV that much anyway. So, you know, this seemed like a nice racket to me, and I'm lucky, particularly with Travel Channel, and that they like me just the way I am. So, you know, I've just had the luxury of being honest and, you know, being my, you know, getting paid to be myself. When that when that equation changes, you know, I'll go do something more dignified with my life.
Well, I admire Gordon Ramsay too, and I've said some things about him, and they kind of refused to talk to me because I guess he was too busy coming to New York.
Well, Ramsay is absolutely the busiest chef, you know. I mean,
yeah.
you could be his mom calling, and it will be difficult. I mean, that is a hard working guy who had a extremely, extremely tough, impoverished, transient childhood, you know, moving from trailer to trailer, changing towns. He acts now, he may have, you know, millions and millions and millions of pounds, but that guy works like at any minute he could lose it all. You know,
yeah.
That's a guy with a significant amount of, you know, it's never going to be enough for that guy because the memory of his childhood and poverty and insecurity and struggle is still so fresh in his brain. That guy will be working 16 hours a day on one project or another, and more likely 12 projects at the same time till the day he dies.
Well, that's interesting because I think a lot of the things that I notice about you is that you are kind of like the underdog lifter. You know, you go to Mexico and visit the homes of the cooks that you work with and they work for you. And I really admire that. And the thing is that I don't think a lot of people really see that part in the flashy cook TV or anything regarding cook. So that's a great thing.
I just listen. It just again, it's. I talk about what I see, and what I've seen, and what I've seen is who's doing the cooking in this country for most of my career, and that's a largely Hispanic population of varying legal status, and you know, it just seems fair to acknowledge who's cooking in America. To pretend they're not there would be complicit in a crime.
Sure,
you know?
We're picking our vegetables
at every level of the food chain. And but I mean, I haven't worked in a farm. I have worked in kitchens for most of my career, and during most of my career, the strongest guys in the kitchen, the steady guys, the guys who I relied on and who are my friends and who I work with, you know, the constant was Latinos, and to pretend that's not the case, that this is, you know, it hurts me, or it disturbs me when I see a restaurant review saying, you know, so-and-so, the chef has a, you know, a delicate hand with herbs, when you know full well, and the writer knows full well, that the chef is, in fact, you know, sitting in the first-class cabin of an Airbus headed to Tokyo. It's, you know, a bunch of Mexican guys executing that food, or
sure,
a mix of Mexican guys and, you know, recent culinary students and cooks. And, you know, I like those guys, and I like writing about them and talking about them. To not do it would be to buy into, you know, a cover story that I just, you know, find kind of.
And what do you think the role of critics and foodies are today?
Well, listen, somebody's got to do it. I don't feel any animosity towards, you know, any honest food critic who's not looking for a free meal, or looking for me to, you know, buy their boyfriend's paintings, or shaking me down for free charity appearances or money. You know, I respect. I may not agree with their assessment. You know, I may not agree with Frank Bruni every week, but, you know, at least he's honest. You know, he goes to extraordinary lengths to you know, be fair. You know, if not him, it's going to be somebody else reviewing the restaurant. So I just don't feel like any animosity. It's never to me like, well, you know, what does he know? Hey, you know, you get a bad review from the Times, you suck it up, you try to do better next time. As far as bloggers, you know, I think the more the merrier.
Sure.
To me, you know, the internet, particularly the foodie internet, you know, it's like a big blank bathroom wall. Anyone is free to write whatever they want about you. I mean, it's the same with writing books. You know, you open a restaurant or you write a book. People are going to post on the internet whatever they feel. It might be Tony sucks, or I hate this book, or, you know, but that's as true a statement as the guy who says, wow, that, you know, best book I ever read, or greatest restaurant ever. you know, there's a grain of truth to somebody in everything. So, I mean, I think it's all valuable.
Yeah, because I read an interview that you did with Gordon Ramsay, and I was reading, and it was before he was reviewed, and I was going, oh, my God, I hope this guy knows what he's getting into, you know? It was like, and then when I read the review, I was like, man, that's really pretty harsh, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think here's an example of, you know, your personality and public statements affecting perception of your food. Gordon's a very, 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 very talented book. I think the Buford article on him in the New Yorker was excellent. And really nailed, as Buford often does, I think. I think he really got Gordon and wrote about him. I think he painted a multidimensional portrait of the guy, and I think it was a very fair assessment of his food. It's not groundbreaking food. It's very respectfully, it's very French.
Yeah.
And he wrote something about how, you know, Ramsay's life has always been so insecure and chaotic that he seeks, you know, harmony on the plate. And I think that was a very, very true statement. You know, Gordon's food is very harmonious. It's not in your face. It's not creative. It's not obnoxious. It's not like him at all. I once wrote about him that he cooks like a pastry chef. You know, his food has a real sort of feminine aspect to it that I find, you know, that I like.
Well, I liked his one show that he had in England where he goes and helps people with restaurants.
That's a great show. That's the real Gordon.
Yeah.
That's the real Gordon. He cares. Gordon's really actually very good with cooks. Cooks like him. He likes cooks. He always pays respect, you'll see on that show, to, like, the dishwasher, you know, the low end of the totem pole. He hates the guy who claims to be the executive chef who's making some shit food, and he's pretty merciless to them. But he's, you know, he's a decent guy.
Yeah. Well, what about Mario Batali? You seem to have a real affinity towards him, and a lot of people kind of are like, oh, God, Mario Batali, you know, with those clogs and everything.
Oh, well, you know, Mario's an example of a guy who's both a good cook, runs great restaurants, and he's really, really good at being a celebrity. I mean, you know, he's too good for some people's taste. He's branded himself. You know, he's created a trademark look. I mean, you know, I think you have to see beyond the orange clogs to see, you know, Mario is probably, I think without question, in fact, easily the smartest chef out there. I mean,
yeah.
He just as soon, Mario could easily do an hour-long show on obscure rock and roll music, you know, probably jazz, Italian neorealist cinema, economics, you know, derivatives. You know, very, very, very smart guy, and one of the reasons that I really respect Mario, beyond the fact that he's runs great restaurants, is incredibly smart and funny, and can party me under the table, is that he's used his celebrity to really do innovative innovative things that would have been difficult, if not impossible, for a chef who was less famous. I mean, a guy could have opened up, you know, 32 Babos across the country. Right after Babo, at the peak of his Food Network fame, he could have easily opened up like the Wolfgang Puck Airport restaurants, serving, you know, $29.95 orders of linguine pomodoro, and he would have made, you know, a lot more money than he's making now. Instead, he figures, hey, you know, now's a good time to sell brains.
What's the weirdest texture that you've ever had, or what's the most disgusting texture you don't like?
Well, texture, I mean, you know, that would have to be anywhere in Chinese culture. They're very into, they like, you know, chewy, gelatinous, rubbery. There's a real place for that, you know, raw abalone or you know, giant sea cucumber, turtle fat. Those are textures that Americans are taught from infancy to sort of avoid and find repulsive.
But they eat Jello.
We like crispy. Well, no, yeah, but when your Jello bites back, you know, imagine chewy Jello.
Yeah.
those are textures that we're really not used to. So those were tricky for me, you know, the first time I had them to really get, you know, that when you hit something rubbery that's hard to chew, that means bad to most Western people.
Yeah.
And to a Chinese, that could well mean good.
I read that you tried hog's anus, and I thought, God, that's really grotesque.
Well, I mean, I wasn't looking for it. I mean, I found myself the guest of honor of a Bushman tribe in the Kahari, and you know, when the chief comes at you with something very special, and the whole tribe is watching you, you know, I try to be a good guest. You know, okay, it was, you know, truly horrifying, but I'm not out there trying to make jackass. You know, I didn't go looking for something bizarre to eat. I was a guest of a very nice group of people who live in very primitive conditions, who don't have much, who have no money and no water, and for whom, if they're lucky enough to shoot a warthog, that's party time. You know, when this chief offers me his best, I'm sucking it up and taking one for the team.
So how far will you go to experience diverse selections or cuts?
I'm not going out of my way. I'm not going out of my way looking for that.
Uh-huh.
I feel very lucky to be traveling and that a network enables me to do this. I find myself in a lot of situations where I'm an honored guest, and to me it's all about just being a good guest. Uh-huh. I want to do, if I've never visited your particular community or culture before, I want what makes you happy, what you like, what you're proud of, whatever that might be. I don't want to eat at the best restaurant in town. I want to kind of tap into what it is that makes your culture different and special. And, I think if I have any virtues, curiosity would be first among them. I try to be a good guest. I try to show that I am as grateful as I in fact am.
Well, I was thinking about that, about how food relates to, we're all kind of foodies here, I guess, in the States and some other continents. And then in some places, it's just, you're eating food because you're hungry and you need to eat. Do you think that talking about food or eating food or trying food in other places will bring people together, make a world peace or something?
I think to a point, there's certainly, it's a huge... icebreaker. It's a great bonding moment. I mean, you establish very early on, really, a degree of intimacy and trust. And I think, it's easy. It's much easier. I've seen so many of the things I've seen around the world. I saw because I had first broken bread, gotten drunk on the local beverage, shared food and appreciated it with, let's say headhunters in Borneo or rice farmers in Vietnam. So many of the things that I was then privy to and was able to see, I never would have seen had I said, I really don't, I'm a vegetarian, or, do you have a Niçoise salad? Will it lead to world peace if we all sit down and eat with each other? I might have thought that before I went to Beirut. Now, I think there are some, forces that will roll over us all, no matter what.
Sure. What about foie gras and this whole pita thing? What do you think about it?
I think that they've been very shrewd in targeting foie gras. I mean, the agenda is to get us all to stop eating meat. Mm-hmm. The spear point is the foie gras issue. It's an easy one because it's a luxury food that's enjoyed by, experienced by, and available to very relatively few people. It's a luxury item. It's suspiciously French, and it sure sounds bad when you describe how it's made. So it's an easy argument for them. It's easy to, on one hand, if you ask people, do you believe in the force feeding of geese and ducks so we can eat their livers? Most people who've never had foie gras will say, well, gee, I don't like that. I'm against it. So it's easy to get good polling on that. It's also easy to terrify and intimidate chefs in taking it off their menu, as I think they've successfully done with Wolfgang Puck. But I think people should understand that the pita people know full well that the horrors committed in the name of fried chicken are far more cruel, far more widespread. They just, that's a hard one.
Or even skinny models.
Eating my what?
Skinny models. I mean, that's pretty cruel what they're doing to those poor girls. They're not.
Well, I actually saw, had debated on a radio show the other day, foie gras, with someone from the Humane Society, was talking about how force feeding ducks and geese led to obesity. And I was like, our children are juvenile diabetes has exploded in this country. It's doubling within a couple of years. you know, these are children, for God's sake, and you're worrying about avian obesity. You know, they're talking about force feeding. We're force feeding people in Guantanamo Bay. You know, it's irritating to me because of priorities, because with so much else wrong in the world and with so much worse animal cruelty. But as a business proposition, it's good business for these guys to target foie gras. It's probably going to be a winner for them. And I, you know, my advice to the world is, you know, enjoy your foie now, because they will almost undoubtedly win in the end and take it away from us.
Yeah, I just made a terrine last week, and I'm like, oh, God, I hope it's not the last one. I'll have to go to Canada.
Yeah, well, they're going to have problems there, too, I think.
Oh, boy.
They're very politically correct up there.
Oh, Lord. I don't know. In Quebec, they might have to, like, separate and just say, no way.
Well, I think all you need to know is that, you know, you can't smoke in a bar, you know, a restaurant or bar or pretty much anywhere in either Sicily or Northern Ireland.
Uh-huh.
You know, if that sort of thing can pass there without problems, anything is possible.
Yeah. Well, speaking of smoking, you're about to have a child. Do you think you're going to quit because of that?
I think I see a future where I'll be smoking less and sticking my head out the window of my 11th floor apartment a lot.
And does it change? I mean, people always say it changes your palate as a chef. Do you think it does?
Most chefs smoke.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, it's a dirty secret, but most chefs are very oral and smoke. I think the world would be shocked of which one of the, you know, which of the great chefs of the world, you know, smoke like fiends. Yeah, of course it affects the palate. You know, that's why we have salt.
What about Ferran Adrià? You were doing a documentary, I heard, did one, and you really got an open door to see what he was doing.
Uh-huh.
Do you think molecular gastronomy kind of changes the structure of the natural product, or am I just fooling myself? Because, you know, when you're cooking something, you're already changing everything.
You know, when I hear people talking about what Ferran Adrià does and saying, I don't like the sound of that, you know, that's not food, it's changing the structure. You know, it's like people who cranky old people who are talking about, these kids today with their music, you know, back in my day, music sounded beautiful. What is this rock and roll? You know, like it or not, 50 years from now, not all, but some of the techniques that he's come up with are going to be, you know, standard operating procedure in restaurants.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Ferran Adrià, I think a lot of the bad rap of what's called molecular gastronomy, a term he does not use, by the way. You know, I think he gets the rap for a lot of his imitators. You know, Ferran cooks Catalonian food. It's very Spanish. It's food. It tastes good. He's a genius. A lot of the people who are over enthusiastic about some of his techniques, you know, all of the, you know, cooking over liquid nitrogen and, you know, I mean, laser beams and all that. You know, there are a lot of less talented practitioners out there who are maybe a little over enthusiastic and, you know, befuddling customers. You know, eating at El Bulli, it's like I've described it as hearing Jimi Hendrix play guitar for the first time or you know, Charlie Parker.
Right.
You know.
Band of Gypsies, that's a great album.
Not my favorite. I'm much more of the Electric Ladyland guy. Never liked Buddy Miles.
All right. If you were going out to dinner tonight, I guess for you it'd be anywhere in the world, where would your place be? What's the spot you really want to go to eat tonight?
Wow. You know, hey, take your pick. You know, Saigon, Singapore, Saigon or Singapore would be great. Or Barcelona.
Isn't it called Ho Chi Minh City now?
They all call it Saigon.
Oh, okay. Just a label.
Yeah.
And I heard that you wanted to go move to Vietnam.
At some point, I hope to spend a year or two there and write a book about the experience, yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's kind of like the Graham Greene novel then.
Well, let's hope I end up more happily than the protagonist in that book. But I mean, I love that book, and it captures a lot of the charm and beauty of Vietnam, as you know, beyond the tragic story and events of the time. It's a magnificent country with great people, filled with proud cooks. They love eating. Their food is fantastic.
Yeah,
you know, it's you know, for me, it's a romantic ideal in a lot of ways.
Have you eaten in the Vietnamese restaurants in, Canal Street?
Yeah, there's some good ones. But once you've eaten in Vietnam, it really kind of ruins, anything less than the real thing for you.
Yeah.
It's like once you've eaten really, really great sushi, utility sushi just doesn't make it anymore.
Yeah, so it's hard for you to eat in New York City now.
I don't eat a lot of Vietnamese in New York, that's for sure.
Yeah.
it's dead for me. If the condiments aren't right, if they don't have, the toothpicks on the table and, the Vietnamese beer, and if it doesn't smell like Vietnam, it just, there are a few that get it pretty right, but, the context is so important in the case of Vietnamese food for me.
You think there's a downturn in, luxury or haute cuisine in
there are a lot of chefs who are dispensing with a lot of the nonsense and pretense and becoming, making their places more informal and straightforward, which is a good thing. Do I think less people are eating in fine dining restaurants? No, I don't. I think I think food is an entertainment form like movies or theater now, and I think there's plenty of room for more.
Uh-huh. And what do you think of the recent Health Department crackdown on closing restaurants?
Well, they just closed Leal yesterday.
I know, I saw that, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to talk to Tony tomorrow.
Yeah, I haven't spoken to the restaurant in some time, but from what I hear, they closed the place down for an environment conducive to rodents. No rodents were found.
Yeah.
But they found the environment conducive to rodents, and I know that from my time, there were, very old drainage pipelines in the cellar that would periodically cause problems. We'd have to get people in, unclog these ancient drains. So if they found standing water in the cellar, I can see that would technically be an environment conducive to rodents. Listen, they're being very aggressive. They seem to be hitting a lot of fairly high-profile places to send a message. What are you going to do? As long as, I remember the days when you could pay off the inspector. Those days are gone. If they're honest, I don't like it, but what can you do?
Yeah. Well, I had just been inspected at my place, and they found three really minor violations, and the guy was just so uppity, going, I don't see it, but I see that this cook is probably not doing what I'm thinking he should be doing when I'm not here. I'm like, what are you, mind reading or what?
Well, I think it is true to say that if in the middle of service, if the health inspectors walked into just about any fine dining restaurant in New York and followed the letter of the law right down the line, that
yeah,
no
we'd
restaurant
all be closed.
Could say, oh, but we'd all be closed.
Yeah.
But I mean, kitchens are cleaner than they used to be. So, I don't know. I'm not happy about it. I'm not gonna be screaming and paranoid and it's not fair and all that. I don't really know the situation. But I do remember, we did have drainage problems, and I guess, they're being much more rigorous about that sort of thing.
Who cooks at home?
I'm on the road so often that when I come home, I'm really, I do a lot of ordering out and eating out. But usually I cook.
And having to travel around and eat everywhere, do you think your body changes? I mean, I know that I go out to eat sometimes, and then I just want to go home and eat something that I made rather than tasting somebody else's food.
I don't know.
The same for you?
I'm having a pretty good time out there. I mean, every once in a while, I get in the mood to just do something very, very simple at home. I like cooking, pasta and simple braised dishes at home. Now and again, I get an overwhelming desire to make a beef bourguignon or something. But no, 30 years of cooking professionally, it's two sides of my brain. Sometimes I cook for pleasure, but when I do, it's something usually very, very simple. Like cooking pasta.
Yeah, it was funny because when I read in your book maybe it was an interview, actually, you were talking about being set out to pasture or turn into glue.
Yeah.
I thought that fit because I said, wow, I've been having knee pains lately. Maybe it's just, psychosomatic reading your book.
Yeah. I love cooking Italian food, but it's tough. My girlfriend's Italian, from Italy, and she's a really harsh critic.
Uh-huh. That could be tough.
Merciless, yeah.
What's your next cooking adventure going to be, or is it not going to be related to food?
As far as where am I going next?
Yeah.
Well, we got a lot of shows in the pipeline. We have like 11 shows in the pipeline we've shot already that haven't aired yet. But next I'm going to Tuscany and Berlin, and then we're doing another season. You know, we just signed for like another 20 episodes. So we're putting together destinations like, you know, Laos. I think we'd like to go to Tokyo, Uruguay, possibly Romania, maybe go back to France, London. You know, a mix of Asian, you know, remote locations, as well as some close to home.
Yeah. Well, my last adventure eating was having cuy in Ecuador.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's good.
Well, yeah, I had it, and it was okay, but I've had amoebas attack me when I was in Ecuador a couple times.
Oh, that's not good. Amoebas
yeah.
are bad. I managed to avoid those.
That's pretty rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, and I don't want to take too much more of your time, but it's been great, and I love your books.
Yeah, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
All right.
All right, enjoy. Have a good one.
Okay, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.